Klar.
Ja, velkommen til NUGs månedlige medlemsmøte i NUG Oslo. Mitt navn Petter Einarsen, jeg formann i NUG og den som arrangerer disse møtene. Vi har i dag vært så heldige å få fløyet over en fyr fra London som har fått på med fritilgjengelig kartteknologi i en årrekke. Han har skrevet en bok sammen med to andre som heter Mapping Hacks, som kommer ut nå på O'Reillys forlag i løpet av de neste 2-3 ukene. Han har jobbet for O'Reilly med systemadministrasjon og vært med i et prosjekt som heter det som holdt på med bygge et trådløs nettverk for det lite lokalsamfunn. Han har har nå holdt på med et kurs for ikke datafolk i bruk av GIS-verktøy, og han har en lang bakgrunn som både lingvist og datamann. Så jeg ønsker hjertelig velkommen til Sugar Eli.
Thank you. Hello everyone. I want to thank you for inviting me out here. It's really, really quite a pleasure. So I would like to start by noting that I tend to speak very quickly in English, and so if I lose anybody, or if at any point you don't know what I'm talking about, just wave your arms in the air and be like, wait a second, and get me to repeat what I said, please, because I don't want to leave anybody behind. I was wondering if I could get kind of a show of hands here, perhaps just to get a sense from you guys of what it is that, what it is you're interested in. How many people here are familiar with the concept of GIS? Raise your hand. Okay, so you all know, basically know GIS is. Okay, good, that's good. I can cut to the chase on that. How many of you have used GIS or cartography software before? Most of you. Okay, good. Oh, wow, that's terrific. Okay, so I assume you all use free software on a regular basis. Okay, terrific. All right. Well, then I can make this talk fairly technical, and hopefully, if I'm not doing enough technical stuff, if I'm doing too much technical stuff, again, wave your arms in the air and say, "Oh, I want to see that instead," because I'm totally happy. So now the reason why you see it looks like five tabs at the top of this talk here at this of these my browser here is because I've given a talk more or less like the one I was hoping to give this evening a bunch of different times, and so I want to kind of show you the highlights of the different ways of looking at the subject of cartography and GIS and free software, and how those things can be democratized, how they can be brought into the mainstream, how they can be made accessible to more and more people. And I want to look at what needs to be done to make that possible, and what we can do as developers and users of free software to make cartography more accessible to people, and why that's important. So I just put this up here as a splash page. This is the Mapping Hacks weblog at mappinghacks.com. My wife, Jill Walsh, and I, and our collaborator, Rich Gibson, co-wrote a book for O'Reilly, as you just heard. And it comes out hopefully the end of this month, maybe early next month. And it is the 550-page version of this talk. So it will tell you everything you want to know in detail, hopefully. And if it doesn't, then hopefully the website will cover more. And hopefully we'll start updating the website again. Okay, so I'll get rid of that. But I just wanted you to be aware that was coming out very shortly. Okay, how many of you are familiar with the basic parameters of cartography, with projections and datums and ellipsoids and... Okay, I only see a few hands here. All right. Okay. Most of you. All right. Let's get to that. Let's see here. All right. So, the central thesis of our book, Mapping Hacks, comes from our co-author Rich Gibson's observation that maps tell stories. Now, this may seem a little bit trite, but it's important to recognize that every map tells some basic story about a place. And actually, maybe I'll skip to, rather than coming here, I will show you guys this instead real quick. Okay, so.
Okay. No. Alright.
What did I do wrong here? Okay, I won't show you guys that stuff. Never mind. Okay. Alright, so this map tells a story. And so what I wanted to show you was three maps of the Big Bend region of Texas. Right? And one map was made by so Big Bend is a extreme southern region of Texas, and it borders on Mexico, and there's a large national park there. And my friend Rich has collected different maps of Big Bend, and one map was made by the Forest Service, and one map was made by the Park Service, and another map was made by a marketing bureau, you know, the local Chamber of Commerce. And you can see how in each of the three maps, there's a different story that's being told, right? The Park Service wants you to know where the park headquarters is, and wants you to know where the park boundaries are, and wants you to know where the points of interest are. Whereas the Marketing Bureau, the Chamber of Commerce, wants you to know where you can buy stuff. And so I like those maps, and I wish I could show them to you now, because they really kind of show a very clear picture of how different maps in the same place can tell different stories. So this map tells a very distinct story, although the story may not be obvious. The story of this map is places that my wife Jo has visited in the United States. And as you can see, she's been up and down the East Coast, and the Northeast a little bit, and she's been to the West Coast. And that's it. Now, strangely, this map looks bizarrely like this map, which is the results of the 2000 presidential election. I think that says something about the United States. Now, I have a map here somewhere that actually shows, I don't have it here, that actually shows the vote in the 2004 election broken down instead of by state, but by county. And it shows a very different picture of the United States. Now, I know, I like to call this previous map, this is sort of, no, not that one. Sorry, I'm confusing myself here. I like to call this map, this is sort of a European's view of the United States. Right? And to look at this map, right, the story that's being told here is the people who are wealthier and better educated live on the coasts. They live in the Northeast, and they live on the West Coast, and some of them live in the Midwest. And everybody else voted Republican. Sorry. Oh, by the way, there is one factual inaccuracy in this map. Who can find it? Florida is in red. Florida voted Democrat in the 2000 election, okay? Don't believe what they tell you. All right, anyway, enough of that. But the point of this map is that this map actually tells a really important story about the United States. This map tells the story of the political composition of the U.S. And actually, if you break this map down into votes by county rather than by state, you discover an even more important story, which is not that the liberals are clustered on the coasts or near bodies of water, but that the liberals are clustered in the cities and the conservatives are clustered in the countryside. Now, this may not be news to anyone, but it's very important because on that simple distinction hangs the entire political balance of the United States, which is, much to my chagrin and dismay, of great importance to all of us. So maps tell stories, and sometimes maps tell very important stories. Let's take a look at this map. So this map may not be immediately recognizable to you. This is a map of the runoff election for mayor in San Francisco in 2003, late 2003. This story is great. I love to tell this story, except for the ending. So in San Francisco, actually in I think most places in California, they have this great innovation called the runoff election, right? Where in most places in the U.S., if somebody runs, a bunch of people run for mayor, the person that gets the most votes wins, even if they don't have a majority. Well, in San Francisco, if you don't get a majority, then you have to run off in another election a month later against the person that got the second most number of votes, and then the person that gets the majority in the runoff election wins. Now, it is quintessential San Francisco that in 2003, in the race for mayor, the leader in the race by a wide margin was a Democrat, but he didn't get a majority. And the runner-up was a Green. which is unheard of in the U.S. I mean, I guess you guys elect Greens here, but no one elects Greens in the United States. And then, of course, I think there might have been a Republican who ran, but nobody voted for them. So in the runoff election was between a Democrat and a Green. And we almost had a Green as a mayor of a major city in the United States. And this map tells the story of that election. So you can see here, this area here in the middle is what I like to refer to as the hipster crescent of San Francisco. You can see the Haight-Ashbury district right here. You can see the Mission district right here. Both of these areas are very heavily populated by young people and by immigrants, particularly Hispanic immigrants. And as the Green candidate was Hispanic also, and they voted for their man. Now, the ideal was, whereas the Democrat was this rich guy, born with a silver spoon in both hands, and he was, you know, he spent $4 million on advertising for the election, whereas the Green candidate spent $400,000, right? And he only ended up getting 10,000 extra votes out of a total of, you know, 800,000 votes cast. So, I mean, the margin was frankly quite embarrassing. But this map tells an important story, right? You can see the Green constituency is right here in the middle of the town. It's where the immigrants live. It's where the hipsters live. Oh, and there's some hippies out by the beach over there. And never mind that green stuff at the top, because that's Presidio, and actually very few people live there, so those figures are a little bit skewed. But there are some interesting things about this map, right? Okay, so now up here in Pacific Heights, which is where the part of the city the Democrat was from, is very, very wealthy. They voted for their man, no surprise. Down here in the sort of southwest corner of the city, largely homeowners, and there was a lot of scare tactics about how property taxes would go up. And so the homeowners in the southwestern portion of the city voted for the Democrat. No big surprise. Okay, now here in this part of the city, Bayview Hunters Point, poor people, mostly African American, right? You would expect them to vote for the populist candidate, but they didn't. Why did they vote for the Democrat? Why did the Chinese immigrants in Chinatown up there in the northern corner of the map, why did they vote for the Democrat? Why did they vote for the rich guy? Now, I claim to have answers to these questions, but I think that if the Green campaign in this election had seen this map and been able to address these questions before the election, we might have had a Green mayor in a major city in the United States. And so I think this goes to show how maps can really tell a very powerful story sometimes and really prompt some very important questions that have a very close bearing on our lives. So I will move on. This is a map of a major city in Europe. Who can guess which city? Anyone?
London.
How'd you guess?
Yalta.
Pardon?
Is it that's where you are from.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
But you didn't guess by looking at the map, did you? No, of course not. See, now here's the thing, right? See, now cartography is both an art and a science, but both halves of that art and science deal with a very central tension. And the tension of cartography is providing enough context that readers of your map can understand your story without providing so much information that the story that you're trying to tell is obscured by all the random crap on your map. This is a case of a map that does not provide enough context. It is impossible to tell what the story of this map is by looking at it. Now, I can tell you that it was the old node map of the Consume Network, the community wireless network in London. And this actually is a very small portion of that map. The map itself, if we zoomed it all the way out, would be, you know, bigger than this wall. I mean, there's at one point a huge number of nodes in the consume.net database. But if you were not familiar with London and you wanted to find a free wireless node in order to get access to the internet, well, there you go. There's the map. Have fun. So now the question we have to ask ourselves is, why didn't these guys put a decent base map underneath their node map, you know? Like, why couldn't they just put some information there so you could see where the freaking wireless nodes were? And the answer is, they're not legally allowed to. The Ordnance Survey holds Crown copyright on GIS data in the UK for 50 years, and any information that they publish, they can charge a license that runs to tens of thousands and even hundreds of thousands of pounds a year. Now, how do you expect an unpaid community wireless network to be able to afford those maps? They can't, and so this is what they produced. This was one of the biggest community networks in the world, and this was the only node map they could produce. This is an embarrassment. This is not right. But that's how national mapping agencies work. And in fact, this is the case here in Norway, unfortunately, that in much the same way, the national mapping agency controls access to that data. They're expected by the government to turn a profit, and so they have to sell that data, and so you don't have access to it. And there was that story that you were telling me over dinner about the Red Cross maps. Do you want to just mention that briefly?
Yeah, last week it was a news announcement that the Red Cross was no longer able to buy the maps they needed to use in their tasks running around in the woods helping people, because the National Mapping Agency had put that task of selling that map to a private company, and the private company discovered that it wasn't really a profitable map to sell, so they stopped selling it, and Red Cross could no longer get the map.
I don't know about you, I'm pretty horrified by that. You know what I mean? It'll make you think twice about hiking out in the woods here, unfortunately. This is the situation that we're faced with, unfortunately, in most of the civilized world, and by that I regretfully have to accept the United States. This, of course, is a map of SFLAN, which is a community network based in San Francisco. Look at that map! Look at all the detail! In fact, this might be an example of a map with too much detail, okay? There's so much stuff going on in this map that it is almost impossible to read. But it's a very stark contrast, isn't it? This is the map of the community wireless network in San Francisco. And this is the map, this is the map of the community wireless network in London. What's wrong with this picture? And the answer is, in the United States, for reasons that are frankly mostly historical, the United States government can't copyright anything. And so if they publish something, it goes into the public domain, and anyone can download and use it. And that's great. That's really, really cool. Because suddenly we can make maps of our community networks that actually tell a story, that actually mean something. And community networks are only the beginning. I mean, again, the maps that I showed of the presidential vote and of the mayoral vote in San Francisco, I think both go to show how if you have access to this information, you can tell really compelling stories. If you don't have access to the information, you don't have enough context to tell a story with. And I think that the contrast is really stark and is really clear. So just to kind of round that discussion out. On the subject of geospatial data and access to geospatial data, you know, we have to ask ourselves, where is that data coming from and how do we get it, right? Now, it turns out that the United States, let me see if this works right now. It turns out that the United States government actually publishes detailed information, reasonably detailed geographic information for the entire world, so that you end up with something like this. So this is free software here, or it would be free software. Sorry. Here we go. Okay. This is based on a piece of software called MapServer, which I will talk about in greater detail later. But as you can see, this is a, you know, frankly, not half bad, if I may say so, map of the world. It could probably use a little bit of work. I'm still learning the art of cartography. But you can see here, you know, as we zoom in, there's a really kind of a stupendous amount of detail in this map. And this is all published for free by irritatingly, the U.S. government. You can't get maps this good for free from your own government, but you can get them from my government. Go figure. Now, the problem with this, this isn't an exceptionally detailed map, all right? Obviously, the borders of Oslo are kind of vague. This map makes it look like you guys only have about 6 roads in the entire city. Question?
Is it Flash-based?
No, actually, this is JavaScript.
Oh.
Yeah, I can talk about the technical details behind this map momentarily, after I'm done ranting about geodata policy. But the point is that I just went and downloaded this data all for free. I loaded it up, and I had to do some massaging of it to get it to look right on a map. But here you go. Now, the problem is, I'm going to steal a slide from my friend Richard's talk. He who controls the description controls the world. And if you look at that map, it's actually a map of Los Angeles. But you'd never know it, would you? It's a map of every McDonald's in Los Angeles. Is it really smart for all of us to be relying on the United States government to provide us with free geographic data? I'm just going to pose that question and let it hang in the air. I'm not going to try and answer it. But, you know. Okay, so back to the point at hand. Okay, so... let's see, where was I going with this? Oh, right. So the case for geospatial data, right, it has to be collected somehow. It's very expensive to collect geospatial data, to do the surveying, to do the GPS data collection. And the national mapping agencies are expected to turn a profit for the most part, at least all across Europe they are. I know certainly in Norway and in the UK they are. So that money has to come from somewhere. So whining to the NMAs is not going to help, unfortunately. It would be nice to be able to go to these guys and say, come on, give us some maps, please. But their hands are tied. So the pressure needs to be put higher up, and it needs to be understood that for the sake of the civic good, for the sake of public infrastructure, this data has got to be accessible to at least some degree. You know, now if they want to collect, you know, super high resolution data and sell it, that's fine. But give us something. Give us something that we can use, something that we can make maps out of, something we can tell stories with. Because it makes a world of difference. It helps make, I don't mean to sound too grandiose, but it helps to make democracy possible. You know, when you can argue effectively about the facts of the world that you live in, that's where democracy starts. You know, so that's where we are with national mapping agencies and that data. So there's a ton of free data that you can get for the world from the U.S. government, and in lieu of anything else that's free, it works. in terms of vector data, there's the vector map of the world level zero. I don't unfortunately have a slide about this, although I do mention it there. That's what this map is based off of, for the most part, is the vector map of the world level zero. It's, I think, 4 CDs of vector data, and it contains all kinds of features, which not even all of which are mentioned here. And it's a pretty good data set. It's, you know, you can see it has the motorways, it has the A roads, it's better than nothing. In terms of raster imagery, Landsat 7 imagery, 15 meter composites, are available from NASA for pretty much the whole world below, I think, about 70 degrees north. 15 meters is pretty good. 15 meters is not enough to make... here, let me show you the Landsat composite. Here we go. Okay, this is a Landsat composite alignment. And as you can see, it's not quite... this is at 1:1 here, so... as you can see, it's not quite detailed enough to make out every single... If you guys ever watched EastEnders, but here it is, you know, it's Landsat 7, and it's free, which is cool. It's 15 meters, so you can't really pick out anything with the really grossest features out of it, but it's free, so that's pretty cool. Let's see, what else do we have here? You can scan out-of-copyright maps. If you're clever enough, if you can find them. This is an 1860s map of made by the Ordnance Survey of London. And we discovered some interesting things in attempting to make... I didn't actually mention the important thing, which is if you can't get free data of the sufficient resolution for the area you're interested in, you can bloody well make it! And that's what we're in the process of doing here. This is part of the London Free Map project, is to collect these lines. London Free Map is sort of tightly integrated with the OpenStreetMap project, which I think actually is more or less how Petter and I met. And I just want to show this to you guys, because it's a really great effort, and it has the ambitions of covering the world. The OpenStreetMap project, the free wiki world map. And the fantasy is that if we can get everybody out there who has a GPS receiver to record traces of the places that they go and upload them all to one place, then we'll republish all that information under an open license. And eventually, hopefully, someday, we'll be able to make free maps of the world. Or at least free street maps of the world. Now, that's a really, really broad fantasy, and we'll see how it works out. But the effort is afoot, and if you're interested in this kind of thing, there's a very active mailing list. There's a lot of really kind of interesting and experimental things going on. I really recommend getting involved in this effort, because I think this is one of the most important things that can be done about data access today. I'm not entirely convinced that we're going to make, you know, street maps of London that are of such high detail that they'll be of enormous utility, but I'm at the very least hoping that we can make maps that are good enough that we will shame the Ordnance Survey into giving us something a little bit more useful. You know, oh, you guys can't make, oh, well, but all right here, you know, that's my hope. apparently, Petter, you have a pretty good map of Oslo going that's also plugged into this, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
so... pick the locations for Oslo, you will get it.
Does it actually currently work?
Kind of.
Give me a lap along.
60... is it 59
probably.
59, I think,
and 10. Free software. Alright, yeah, so this is under active development, and what's more, the guy who maintains this particular website is, I think, still in the middle of finals. So, try it again in a couple of weeks. No, but seriously, there's a mailing list. If you come to the Get Involved link here, you know, we need hackers to work on this stuff. This website is, I guess it's not intrinsically obvious, but this website is written in JSP, which I'm not a huge fan of. And, I would like to have some other alternatives that don't involve Java. But here it is. You know, you can upload your GPS tracks and you can make maps out of them. Let's try. Let's see, there was a pretty good example for London here. Let's see if that still works. No. Okay, sorry. But yeah, keep an eye on that site, because that's the other possibility is if we can't beg it, and we can't buy it, and we can't borrow it, then we'll bloody well make it.
Go to the developers, go to Linux Addon. The DRE. Yes. Enter. Pick the open bitmap.
Yeah, cool.
And go for the sharing builder.
Second paragraph. Second
paragraph. That's Oslo.
No. Are those all your GPS traces?
No, that's two months of them. And 1.5 year.
Okay. Now the first thing I'm impressed. Okay, now the first thing I'd like to point out about this map is you see how stretched it is? This is a projection issue, right? Because at 60 degrees latitude north, and in fact you guys are at 60 degrees. Latitude. The ratio of a degree of latitude to a degree of longitude to a degree of latitude is 2:1. It's the cosine of 60 degrees. So you end up with this map being stretched by a aspect ratio of 2:1 because it's unprojected. If the map was projected into, let's say, the Universal Transverse Mercator or UTM projection, then it would be the right size and shape. So these are the things that you have to worry about when you're dealing with open source GIS, for better or for worse. Now, the irritating thing is that this actually was done in a piece of free software called Quantum GIS. If you guys are not familiar with GIS software and you want to get started with a good free GIS browser, Quantum GIS or QGIS comes very strongly recommended. I think it's qgis.sourceforge.net. And it's a really useful piece of software, especially if, you know, you downloaded some geodata off the web and you just want to freaking look at it to see what it is. QGIS is really good for that. And as you can see, it's got, did you use the GPX import?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It has a GPS, so there's an XML file format called GPX, which is becoming sort of a de facto standard for GPS data interchange. It's not the most compact format on Earth, but it is parsable by most programs. And as you can see, Quantum GIS can read GPX and convert it into geospatial data, and it does a pretty good job. This is pretty cool. I recommend checking out QGIS. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it. It is not entirely correct to call Quantum GIS a GIS application, because GIS involves not merely viewing maps, or making maps, but also being able to do different kinds of geospatial analysis. And I'll get into what I mean by that momentarily. Let's see, where was I? Okay, isn't that nice? I won't get to that yet. Okay, here's another story that maps tell. Okay. So as you can see, this is the Landsat 7 image that we composited of London. So Landsat 7 comes in 8 bands, in spite of the fact that it's called Landsat 7. The first 3 bands are these are spectral bands, so they're actually grayscale images, but they're grayscale that's focused on a particular wavelength of light. Its emphasis is around a particular wavelength of light. So you have one spectral band for blue light, one for green light, one for red light. You have one for near infrared, 2 for medium infrared, and then you have a thermal band, and then you have a what's referred to as a panchromatic band. So the first seven bands are all at 30 meters resolution. The eighth band is at 15 meters resolution. And you can do some tomfoolery in the GIS to make a single RGB image that is ostensibly 15 meters, which is what you're looking at here. So this is our Landsat 7 composite of London, with some GPS tracks shown over top, just as an example. And the outline of that ordnance survey map that I showed earlier. Listed building permits. So what Joe did was she went and scraped the Tower Hamlets, the municipal website for zoning permits. Am I using the right term for that? Zoning? Like building permission. Like when you have to apply for building permission with the city in order to be able to make changes to a building. So in the UK they have this idea of listed buildings. Are you guys familiar with that? Like historic buildings that are believed to have some kind of significance. And so you have to apply for a special permit to make changes to listed buildings because they have historical significance. Okay, so this is a map that Joe made of the listed building permits that were requested in Tower Hamletsborough. Okay, now it's a little bit difficult to make out with the coloring of this map, and if I had our other composite, it would be clearer. But this area here, this area here that's all sort of gray and white, is the city. Right, it's the very center of London. It's the commercial and financial center. Oh, cheers. All right, so yeah, this area here, as you can see, is the very built-up center of London, right? And it's the what's referred to as the city. You know, it's the square mile. It's the center of London. This area over here is Tower Hamlets. This is a much more residential area. And right here, you see, there's this whole cluster of listed building permits right on the edge between the city and the East End. It's like the city is kind of like growing eastwards, eating into Tower Hamlets, kind of bit by bit. Anyway, that's what I see. That's what I see when I look at this map, is where are developers asking for permission to change historic buildings? And it's right here on the edge of the city. Right? It's as if the city is growing eastwards. That's the story that I see when I look at this map. So again, when we look at maps that tell stories, they can tell stories on a personal level, or on a municipal level, or on a national level, or on a world level. How am I doing for time?
Half an hour.
Oh, I said I have half an hour?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's great. Okay, cool. All right. Well, just since I'm on the subject right now, I'll show you guys. I'll show you guys an example of geospatial analysis. This here is a population density map of Europe made with, again, free data that I downloaded from some silly website. It looks pretty plausible. If you look at these population centers, you can make out major cities and recognizable places and so on and so forth. But it's really interesting when you overlay that map with this map. Let me put the two side by side. Okay, so this here is a topo map of Europe, right? This is the coastline of Europe here with the areas in the topo highlighted, right? Now, if, let's say, the polar ice caps melted and the sea level rose by 10 meters, which unfortunately is not that far-fetched of an idea, then the coastline of Europe would look like that. And just to put a finer point on it, actually, that's kind of cool. Okay. So now this was done using the GIS software, right? Basically, what I did was I used a program called GRASS for this. How many of you are familiar with GRASS? Okay, you are a few. You at least heard of it. Okay, GRASS stands for Geographic Resource Analysis and Support System, but it is the open source GIS. And for those of you who love command line interfaces, you're in luck because it's a command line GIS. And it's been around for about 25 years, and it does everything that the commercial ESRI, ArcView, ArcInfo software does, but it's all done through the command line, and it's free. So what I did was I got some elevation data for Europe, and I loaded it into, so this is raster data. So there's two different kinds of GIS data. Are you guys familiar with the difference, raster and vector? Yeah, okay, I see a bunch of nods. All right, cool. So I downloaded some raster data for elevations around Europe, and I colored it in such a way. As you can see, that the blue areas are ocean and the green areas are not ocean. And then I went through and said, okay, let's do a little bit of map algebra, right? Let's find all of the cells that have an elevation that's below 10 meters
and copy them out into a separate layer, right?
Actually, I think I made this map by just saying, you know, colorize
everything up to 10 meters as if it were water, and then colorize everything else as if it were land.
But I actually pulled them out into a separate layer
in order to be able to do a little bit of math.
So then what I did was I found all of the cells in this map that were below 10 meters in elevation, and then said, okay, give me the population from the population layer and sum them all together,
right?
And so what that gives us, in principle, right, this is geospatial analysis. We're asking questions of the map. The question we want to know is, if the sea level rises by 10 meters, how many people in Western Europe are going to be displaced? And according to GRASS, the answer is approximately 42 million people. And this is using population figures from 5 years ago. So that's an awful lot of people. And I haven't done I did the math for the eastern United States, and again, the figure was 25 million people live in areas that are below 10 meters above sea level. I haven't done the math for Bangladesh because I'm afraid to. But you can imagine. And yeah, so you know, this is the world we live in. And again, these maps can tell stories. And in this case, the story is we got to quit burning hydrocarbons, folks. But you know, that may be neither here nor there. But the point is that this is a map that allows us to tell a story that we have extracted through geospatial analysis. So it's not just we drew a map and made some pretty pictures on it. Like, we actually had to go through a process of evaluating, comparing different data sets in order to arrive at what might or might not be a meaningful answer. So that is kind of the nutshell version of like what I really wanted to talk about. So we could, I love that. okay, so we could talk more about free software and so on. So you guys have seen QGIS. I mentioned GRASS. I could show you GRASS. GRASS is a very steep learning curve, I'm afraid. Part of that is because it's 25 years old. Part of that is because it's command line based. But if you really like command lines, like I really like command lines, then you'll probably feel right at home with it after a while. The other thing, of course, that will trip you up is that QGIS and GRASS, and in fact most of the open source GIS software out there, assumes that you know what you're doing with respect to GIS. We were talking about this over dinner briefly. What we're looking at here, right, is a quantum leap, or maybe a phase shift, in the way that people relate to maps, right? Because historically maps were a read-only medium. Historically, it took huge amounts of data and huge amounts of skill to be able to make a decent map, right? And thanks to Moore's Law, in the last 18 months, everybody has gotten a computer on their desktop that can make good maps, that has a hard drive that's big enough and a CPU that's fast enough to do the kind of processing that's necessary to make decent maps. So suddenly maps have gone from a read-only medium, right, except for a very few experts, to potentially a read-write medium that's accessible to anyone. Now anyone can tell their story with maps. Anyone can give their rendition of the world. And, you know, we're not limited to, you know, somebody else's idea of what a map should be. The problem is that the software has not caught up with the hardware. And this is sort of a call to action for you free software hackers out here. We need to find, I think that it's incumbent upon us to find ways to make the art and the science of cartography accessible to people. I think that the existing GIS software assumes that you know what you're talking about when it asks you questions about what projection your map data is in, or what ellipsoid you're using, or what datum you're using. And most people don't want to have to care. And what's more, most people shouldn't have to care. Because as often as not, this is the 21st century, okay? And as often as not, when you download data off the web, it comes with reasonable metadata. And so the program, the software that you use, should be able to infer what projection you're using, what datum you're using, what ellipsoid you're using, and so on. The map should be able to infer if all of your data is in latitude and longitude, well, that's going to look like, well, it's not going to look very good anyway if you're in Oslo, because Oslo is at 60 degrees north, right? And it's just a fundamental limitation of an unprojected map, right? Because you end up with this 2-to-1 skew. So the program should know enough to go, this is a map of Oslo, it's at 60 degrees north. Maybe I should reproject it into something that actually looks half decent. And there should be some kind of setting under the hood where if you want to go to, you know, edit options and say, don't reproject my map, you fool, you should be able to do that. You should be able to get under the hood and change these things. But the software should encapsulate the expertise that GIS experts have
and make it accessible to people who are not GIS experts. In much the same way that, for example, you know, the GIMP, or if you prefer, a non-free software, Illustrator, has made the art of design and you know, graphic design accessible to people who are not experts in that field. Software can encapsulate expertise, and that is actually one of its great strengths, is its ability to reproducibly encapsulate expertise. And in order for cartography to be democratizable, we need software that encapsulates the expertise of GIS experts in order to make it accessible to people. Now, it almost feels like the end of a talk, but I guess I natter on for about 20 minutes. You guys want to talk about GIS? I mean, GPS? Let's see here. I had some really great slides relating to grass, and I cannot figure out what I did with them. Am I going to make you guys sit here and watch while I log into the server and Chamath the directory? I don't even have a key on this machine. Jeez. If I can beg your forbearance for, you know, a couple of minutes here, I'm going to log into the server and Chamath that damn directory. That's almost illegible. Yeah, I'm sorry about this. I figured that this stuff would be...
It's the web server settings.
Oh, you're probably right. Probably right. Yeah. No, wait, that stuff's all world readable. What the hell?
It's the web server settings.
Oh, as in it's just not configured to do an automatic... Oh. Alright, I'm not editing HTTPD.conf in front of you. Alright, hang on one second while I try and read that dodgy blue text and remember which document I wanted to show. Is it... Oh, that didn't help.
Don't have option no color.
What's this?
With no color.
Yeah.
The easiest way to do it is to... Like to do -sh
sh
and star when you get all the listings.
Okay.
And with no color.
Alright, well, I'm giving up on that. I'm going to figure out where. Because this, the you gave a 3-hour tutorial on. You gave a 3-hour tutorial on this subject, and I figured I could give you the 20-minute condensed version. Oh, God, it's so painful. All right, so you're saying ls-sh.
Yeah.
Echo okay. Star.
Echo star.
Just use echo star.
Ooh. Oh, echo. Oh, I see. Aha. Oh, that's good. Now, why doesn't this talk work? All right, I'm taking a big chance here, folks. Cross your fingers. All right, screw it. So wait, the slides all went away, but the... What the heck? Oh, man, what did he do to this thing? Alright, this might be a lost cause. Oh man, that's a bummer. I could have sworn all this stuff was up there at some point. Okay, so does anybody have any questions at this point while I'm arsing about with this? Anybody? No questions? Okay, well, I guess that's reassuring in a way. Either that or I've lost you all completely. Oh.
free software GIS tool with a graphical user interface?
That is a good question.
You probably know the answer as well as I do. I mean, there's QuantumGIS. Grass does have a graphical interface. I mean, obviously it has to because you're dealing with geographic data. You're dealing with maps, but it's a bit on the obtuse side. I don't really know besides that. Oh, here we go. Oh, okay, cool. All right. Okay, I'm going to give you the 5-minute version of what was originally a 45-minute talk. Okay, so yeah, you know this. Kind of know that. Okay. So Grass is hard to use. It's got a command line, quirky syntax, difficult to install. So don't use it. Use QGIS instead. QGIS is probably the best option. There's also another browser called Thuban, Thuban. Instead of being Qt based and written in C++, it's Python based and it's written in, sorry, it's GTK based and it's written in Python. But they are effectively the same. So, let's see here. Oh, this here says Grass 5.7 is the latest version, but it's not. Actually, Grass 6 is the latest version. God, this is horrible. Oh, okay, all right. So, as soon as you start Grass, you'll get this really, really horrible opening screen. Grass comes with a TickleTK interface. You guys familiar with TickleTK? You ever wanted to like stab yourself in the eye when you've seen a TickleTK interface? I hate TickleTK. Can't stand it. So I always turn this off. There's a file called .grassrc6 that pops up in your home directory when you run Grass for the first time. You can go into your grassrc6 file and disable this once and for all. But this does illustrate the key thing, of course, with getting started with Grass, which is that you need a location, right, which encapsulates all of your projection details. And then you need a map set, which is just like a folder that holds your maps. And that's basically it. Oh, and you need a database directory, which is just a place where all this stuff goes. Parenthetically, there's all this stuff and more is either in mappinghacks.com/talks or will be. We just covered this. Okay. Yeah, so your location stores the common extents projection and geodetic datum of your different map sets, and then the map set each map set just contains a list of thematically related layers. So, should I just show this to you rather than paging through these slides?
Yeah.
Do you guys actually want to see this? Okay. Alright.
13 minutes left.
Okay, cool. I'm wondering what else I should talk. The other thing that I could talk about that I haven't really covered in the time that we've used up so far is GPS. How many of you are familiar with GPS? Okay, you're all familiar with it. Do you all more or less understand how it works? Okay, cool. I love GPS. GPS is so cool. All right, I just have to share this one little factoid about GPS, right? Okay, so now if it wasn't cool enough that GPS relies on the special theory of relativity to operate, right? Because it depends on a constant speed of light, basically the constant speed of electromagnetic propagation in order to function, right? But what's even cooler than that is that it turns out that the general theory of relativity predicts that clocks will move slower in proximity to a large gravitational field, right? So a clock on the surface of the Earth will be slower than a clock in orbit, because gravity slows down time. And as it turns out, this is experimentally verifiable with the GPS satellites. They actually have to correct the atomic clock on the GPS satellites that's 600 kilometers in orbit by 12 microseconds a year. And 12 microseconds is less than the blink of an eye, right? Sneezing, you'll miss it. But they actually have to correct these clocks on the GPS satellites by 12 microseconds a year to account for the general relativistic effect. The fact that they're 600 kilometers above the Earth's surface and the clocks that are on the Earth's surface move 12 microseconds slower every year. I think that's really cool. Because this is where we're talking about a technology that fits in your pocket. I mean, really, it's the 21st century, finally. So Grass. Do I have Grass 6 installed on the Grass 6? Can you guys read that? Is that too small? Okay. I haven't even disabled the TickleTK interface. Okay, so what have I got here that I can show you?
So there's this map set of Europe. Yeah, I haven't got anything that's significantly more upsetting in there. Yeah, see, isn't that horrible? Hate it. Go away. Okay, so the grass command line is your friend. It used to be the case that you could say, gee, what's this command? Man g dot version.
Oh, wow.
Okay, that still works on Debian. I'm really impressed. Actually, I'm really impressed. Okay, so this is the thing. You see this command line here? Right?
It's just a shell! It's just a shell!
Except that it's got all these special commands. So if you type in, like, let's say, r dot whatever, right? These are all the raster commands. All the commands that come with grass for dealing with raster layers. So r dot is raster commands. So you can guess v dot is... Bingo! Vector commands. D stands for display. So for example, if we wanted to display a vector layer, we would have to start by saying d. We'd have to start by saying d dot mon start equals x zero, right? Which it's really cryptic, isn't it? It's classic Unix. But there it is. D dot mon start equals x zero, which says start a display monitor called x zero. I don't know. These are x monitors, so they're numbered x139. So we can start like 12 of them. There. Okay. All right, so now let's display a raster layer. Well, I don't actually even remember what raster layers are available in this data set. So we use the G command. G is general. G is any command that deals with all types of layers. So we say g.list, which says, give me a list of layers, right? If you do that, it does this. I go, gosh, stop, go away. If you don't like that, you can say --?, or probably even --help. Because again, this is Unix. This is your Unix shell. You're used to this. So we say g.list type equals rast. Show me the raster layers. Bonk. Well, that's a good one. I don't remember putting that one in there. Okay. All right. So let's say d.rast dem. Okay. So the problem was I started up a whole bunch of monitors, and then it thought I was connected to the last monitor that I started, and now I'm not connected to any monitor because I killed them. So I say d.mon select equals x0, and then d.rast, which says display rast. And, it's able. Alright, so this is clearly not what we want to be looking at. So let me d.zoom out. Right, okay, so d.zoom is, it's a display command, it's zoom. Now, d.zoom has got possibly the most irritating user interface of any command ever written. Right, so now, let's say you wanted to zoom in, okay? So let's zoom in on, the Alps here, right? So you would left click to start your zoom box, and then you left click to stop your zoom box. But no, wait, no, you don't left click to stop your zoom box. You left click to create a zoom box, and then if you left click again, you create a new zoom box. You have to middle click to close your zoom box. It's the most irritating thing ever designed, but you do get used to it after a while. So left click to start zooming, middle click to stop zooming. Like I said, you do get used to it. So now this data, I think, is 1 kilometer resolution, so it's not exceptionally high res. It might even be slightly less than that. But you can get 90-meter digital elevation models, again, from the United States government. They're called SRTM, Shuttle Radar Topography Mission. In the year 2000, they put a radar beam, a radar transponder, on the shuttle, and they flew the Earth in a helical orbit and mapped the radar elevation of... something like 90% of the Earth's surface. And they published all the data for free on the web. The thing about SRTM that's important to remember is that what is shown in SRTM is not ground elevation. It's radar elevation. So the radar will bounce off of treetops. It'll bounce off of building tops. The SRTM data for San Francisco shows this terrifying discontinuity in what turns out to be the business district, where you see there's this hill, and then suddenly there's this enormous peak of something, and it's a skyscraper, of course, because the radar bounced off the top of the skyscraper. The other problems that you will encounter are that SRTM data frequently has null values. You'll find places where, for example, this happens particularly either over water or over steep-sided hills, where presumably the radar bounced the wrong way. Like the radar was shot down to the Earth's surface, it hit an oblique surface and went that way instead of back up to the shuttle. So I have a friend in India who attempted to make hiking maps of the Himalayas.
with SRTM data, and he found that the parts of the Himalayas that he was interested in were so steep that there was so much null data it turns out you can use GRASS to do spline interpolation on null data. So if you have a region of null data in a raster image like this one, and you can tell GRASS, well, just interpolate. He found that attempting to interpolate the null data areas turned the Himalayas into a range of flat-topped mountains. So these techniques don't work perfectly, the data doesn't work perfectly, but if you're not trying to map the tallest mountains on the planet, you're usually okay. And in fact, this data can be used, for example, one of the original purposes that we used data very similar to this for was doing wireless network analysis in Northern California, which is very hilly. And we wanted to know, you know, who could connect to whom in an 802.11, long-range 802.11b network, which, as you know, of course, the 802.11b can't go through hills, and so we had to know where the hills were in order to figure out who could get line of sight to whom. And it works, more or less. So the digital elevation model is very useful. And you can, in fact, merge them. This is actually, I feel a bit dumbfounded that I didn't show this to you before. But this is, I actually made this with Pauvre, which I think is cool. It's unfortunately this took like 2 hours to render on this laptop. But as you can see, this is a 3D fly-through of Bilbao, Spain. And this was made using a Landsat 7 composite draped over top of, basically I turned the SRTM data into a height field that was readable by Pauvre, and then draped the Landsat imagery over top as a base mapping. You know, it looks pretty good. I've never been to Bilbao, but I mean, you know, it looks pretty good, let's say. So we made another one. Let me see if I have that one on this machine. I might actually. We made another one of the Straits of Gibraltar. Ah, yes. Cool, I do have that one on me also. And again, this was all made with free software. We composited the Landsat imagery with GRASS. We cleaned up the... it's Pillars of Hercules. I mean, you know, it's not too bad. You can do all this stuff in real time. There's a program called Worldwind, which downloads SRTM data and satellite imagery in real time. Not real time satellite imagery, but it downloads the satellite imagery over the net as you're browsing through it. It's somewhat similar to Keyhole. It's like a free version of Keyhole. It's written in C# and published by NASA, and it doesn't work on Linux yet, much to my chagrin. But it does stuff like this.
It does.
And it's supposedly really cool.
It's a sort of version from Linux as well.
Pardon?
Well, you can get the Worldwind for Linux.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool. When did that happen?
Not long ago, I suppose.
Huh? Cool. All right. So you don't have to stoop to using 15-year-old ray tracing software to make this stuff. You can actually make it in real time. I'm just kind of anachronistic in some of my habits. And I made a third one of Tokyo Bay that I don't think is on here, but it doesn't look quite as cool because, as it turns out, Tokyo Bay is pretty flat. So back to the point at hand, right? So now GRASS has this idea of a current region, which is very important because the region constrains. How much time do we have left, by the way? 5 minutes? Okay. The current region constrains the area in which your actions operate, right? So if I was to do some sort of, let's say, a raster export of the elevation model layer that we're looking at right now, then it would just export this part of northern Italy, because that's what the region is currently set to. And if you wanted it to export the whole thing, you'd have to say something like g.region rast equals dem, right? Set the region to the region of the raster called dem, and then if we do a d.redraw, you can see, ta-da, we get the whole map. So it's important to understand that, and a lot of newbies get tripped up when they're dealing with GRASS because they forget to either reset the region or they forget to reset. Another important thing to consider is the current resolution. And unfortunately, this map is projected into latitude and longitude, and so it gives the resolution in minutes and seconds. But There it is. Since I only have 5 minutes left, I was going to go into some of the process of doing the map algebra. They gave me the figure of 40 million displaced people from Western Europe. I don't know if I have time for that. Are there any questions? I don't want to bore you guys to death yet. No. Question.
I was wondering, these projects, OpenStreetMap, etc., how many people work in them, and where are they? What countries are most active?
I would say the UK is primarily the most active. Other than the fact that it's originally an English project, I don't really know what else to attribute that to. Do you know of any other efforts that are similar to that are being done in other countries? I mean, OpenStreetMap is intended to be an international project. And it is an international project. It's not especially, it's not very international yet, but I'm hoping it will be. Do you know of any others?
Yeah.
But I'm sure other people have thought of this and are working on it. There's an interesting question right now, which is, can geodata be paid for by advertising? You know, I mean, Google has come out with really nice maps of the United States and really nice maps of the UK. And you know what? They're paying for every click. They have to be. They absolutely have to be, because that's the licensing terms of the commercial suppliers that they got this data from. So now Google is obviously taking some kind of gamble wherein they're saying, we can pay for this data, we can pay for the license to this data with advertising. That has to be the business model that they're pursuing, unless anybody else can think of any others. I've thought about this for a little bit, and I would be gladly contradicted. But there's an interesting question, right? Go on.
Could we just ask McDonald's to pay for it?
Yeah, if you want the map to look like that one, yeah, sure. But that's the question, you know, is in some ways the free geodata movement doomed because everybody's going to go and use Google Maps because Google has really, really shiny, nice-looking maps, and they're paying for those maps, but the cost of those maps is prorated across so many eyeballs and so many ad views that it costs them nothing per hit, or they make a profit per hit. Wanting to make non-commercial projects, wanting to make projects that are unencumbered. For free data, for free geodata, free in the freedom sense, not free in the, you know. I think there still will be a place for those data sets, even if Google does manage to demonstrate that data collection, the geodata collection, can in fact be paid for with advertising. That's my 2 cents on that subject. So I don't know what the, yes, we're out of time.
Are there any good document formats for mapping data?
Oh my goodness. Okay, so the canonical data formats that you should know about. The first one is called, the canonical vector data format is called shapefile, ESRI shapefile. And it's a bit of a misleading term because shapefiles aren't actually a single file. They're like four different files. And the irony, so vector data, right, is obviously, as you would expect, a series of vector geometries, but associated with each feature in the vector geometry is a set of attribute data. So each vector feature is identified by some bit of tabular data, right? So you've got some kind of schema definition, like an SQL schema, defined for that bit of vector data. And then each feature in the vector data has got a row associated with it. Well, didn't you know it, but ESRI shapefiles use DBase4 FoxPro as the tabular format. So if you download a shapefile off of the web, it'll usually come as a zip file or a tarball. And if you untar it, you'll see a .shp file, which is the vector data. And then you'll see a .dbf file. And that's actually a DBase file. And it still works. And it's actually pretty efficient. And you can load that DBase file into OpenOffice and edit it and save it back out. And it still works. I think that's cool. So that's important to know about shapefiles. It's important to know that you can actually edit the DBF files by hand. It's important to know that for raster data, probably GeoTIFF is the most commonly used data format, I would say, for raster data. It's basically TIFF. It's a standard TIFF image format, but with a series of extra headers in the image file that describe the geographic extents of the image. Sometimes you'll see raster data that's shipped in either TIFF format or JPEG format with a file that's accompanied with, that's like .tfw or .jpw. Those are called world files. And those files contain six lines which basically describe the extents, the skew, and the tilt, you know, the rotation, the rotational tilt of the image with respect to the ground. So you have this rectangular raster, but the area of the planet Earth that it represents might be tilted like this, or it might be, you know, oriented here or whatever. And so if you get TIFF data, you want to make sure that you get either that the georeferencing information is either embedded in the file or that you get the world file separately, because otherwise that image will be useless to you. Unreferenced geodata is as good as no geodata at all, almost. Although you can reference the data yourself. I have one last thing to show. I just remembered this. This was for a while my flagship geo project, and I lost a little bit of momentum with it because I had to start working on stuff that actually put food on my table. But well, you know how it is. But I just want to show this to you guys because I want you to. I would really love people to think about what's possible. And I think that's more important than what's actually being done now. So this is intended to be the Locative Media Toolkit. The Locative Media Toolkit is supposed to be an end-user utility for telling stories with your geodata and with your digital media, right? So the idea is you create a project here. That's no surprise. Okay, this is written in Python. It uses GTK. It will be open source as soon as I have a working version working. I dig it. It's the thing I really like about Python and GTK is it runs out of the box on Windows. So you actually can have a user base. I really like that, actually. Okay, so the idea is here you can load up a bunch of waypoints and a bunch of track logs from your GPS data. And then let us suppose that you have a map, maybe you scan a map. Right? Like, let's say, for example, you scan a map. This is a Suomenlinna island in Helsinki. But the idea is that you would be able to take these waypoints and literally just drag and drop them onto the map, right, and position them exactly. And then the software would be able to use the coordinates associated with each of those waypoints and the locations that you put them on the map to georeference the entire map. So now you have some scanned map or a piece of you know, raw image data that you got from somewhere that you want to turn into a map, and now it has geographic coordinates. So it is possible if you have, these are referred to as ground control points, although just called waypoints here because they're from GPS, but you can use ground control points to georeference an arbitrary image, which can have some pretty humorous results sometimes. So the idea is you kind of move through this workflow process here. And so now let's say you have a digital camera, and if you go out with a GPS receiver in one hand and a digital camera in the other hand, right, well, how do you synchronize the two? Well, you can use what Rich calls the universal foreign key, time, right? Because your GPS receiver has a clock in it. It has to have a clock in it because otherwise it wouldn't be able to figure out where your position was, right? Your digital camera has a clock in it. Now, if you take the trouble to synchronize the two ahead of time, right, then you can go back and use linear interpolation to estimate where you were at the instant that you took a given photograph. So therefore, you know more or less where that photograph was taken from. And so then the fantasy is that you would be able to import your photographs, right? And I actually have a better screenshot than this somewhere. But you would actually be able to either manually drag these photographs onto the map, right? Or you would be able to click some button here that just says automatically georeference my photographs. And it would look at the timestamps in the EXIF headers and the JPEG images, and it would look at the timestamps in your track log, and it would say, okay, you were here when this photograph was taken, so I'm going to place an icon on the map, right? And then finally, and again, this is we've actually done prototypes of this, but I don't actually have a working version of this working yet. And the idea is that you would be able to output to, let's say, some kind of DHTML map with little camera icons on it. And when somebody moused over the camera icon, you'd be able to see a thumbnail of the image. And if they clicked on it, it would take you to the full-size version. And so you'd be able to tell a story of your travels with both digital media and a map working together. And I think that this is one of the potential futures. I wish I could show you this in more detail, but I don't really have time. This is one of the potential futures of what some of my collaborators like to call locative media, is the synthesis of digital media and maps and storytelling to really create, you know, some pretty interesting stories. And hopefully that's where all this is going. I would really love to see the uses of this data be primarily peaceful and friendly and
not be so political and not be so, you know, why is the world so messed up? I would like the world to be less messed up so we can spend more time playing with this stuff. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was an inspiring talk.
Oh, thanks.
I brought you a small piece of glass.
It's the bear!
The polar bear?
Oh, that's fantastic.
The nuke symbol?
Oh, well, thank you very much. Well, thank you all very much. I'll keep this on my desk. Terrific. Thank you.
We'll go to the bar next to Salogino, the Addis. Just straight from there. So please join us. Thank you.
Thank you all.
That's cute.
Oh, like it's here?
Let me pack up. Yes. Am I being coming to your foot off?
Fantastic.